I just believe in the process, and we're going to win going through the process.
Now, Bills Mafia, it's time for the main event. So sit back and enjoy the show.
Bills Mafia, welcome to another episode of the Red, White and Buffalo Blues, a UK Bills podcast. Joining Robin and myself, hey, Matt, we have Matt Waldman.
Yes. From
So for Robin, it's going to be very confusing to say which Matt's which. But
British Matt, American Matt.
Thank you ever so much for coming on the show.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me. And you know, it's always fun to be able to talk about the draft, and especially when it's, you know, focused on a team that's contending for a Super Bowl like the Buffalo Bills. That's always it's always going to be a pleasant conversation from that perspective.
Yeah. So obviously with you, obviously if people don't follow you on X or social and all that, you've been the creator of the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. I don't know if you want to just talk a bit more about what you actually do with that, because I've had a look through and it's very analytical, let's put it that way, compared to some of the other draft related stuff or even just anything to do NFL analytics.
Sure, Matt. You know, the Rookie Scouting Portfolio is a 19-year-old publication. It is one of the two most purchased draft guides by NFL people, that in terms of individual independent draft guides that are out there for cross-checking purposes, at least according to recruiters like Alex Brown, who is at Ole Miss and who was the head of recruiting at SMU and also worked at Rice and Houston. And I've heard that from other people who are in the industry or in the NFL who've gotten the work. So it's an NFL. It's really rooted in process management, operations management, quality management principles, something that I did in my past life, and took really world-class process improvement measures for how to evaluate performance and applied them to how would I evaluate football players. And part of what that is having a process that's encouraging growth of knowledge, growth of how to reduce variation in terms of how you look at things. So when you look at the Rookie Scouting Portfolio, it looks like a choose your own adventure draft guide PDF, because if you want to look at just simple straight rankings and tables that you would see in a lot of draft guides where it's just like three sentences, combine information, what school the player went to and what your score was without any explanation, you can do that. If you want to see what the scouting report is on the guy on every conceivable aspect of technique concept that the position requires or could require, I provide that too. So you can get scouting reports that give you 1 to 5 pages in length, usually more on the side of, you know, 3 to 5 pages in length in a lot of these with the higher end prospects. And then if you want to see my process, I take you through my process in as entertaining way as possible to show you how they stack up in these areas, how I define what these criteria are. So if you wanted to do it yourself, and I've got some nutsos in, you know, South America and in parts of Europe and in other places who are literally sharing what they've done with my process to study wide receivers, for instance. And I admire them for it. You can do that. And so, you know, it's written from a perspective of my operations management expertise, applied to football and what I've gained from learning about the game, through my evaluations, as well as where I've met people, you know, in coaching and in development. Yeah. You know, I've done some work with Will Hewlett, who is the quarterback coach to Brock Purdy and Anthony Richardson and Caleb Williams pre-draft. So I've supplied some reports to them, things like that. And, but I provide that in a real football sense, very low frills, deep into football. But I've also been a fantasy football writer since 2003. And I write a football guide as a senior staff writer there. And so I give you a fantasy take post-draft where you get a post-draft publication, and they're both available for one price at mattwaldman.com. And it's, you know, it's definitely one of the most comprehensive looks you'll see at those four positions that are around.
So then in that instance, there's obviously everyone has their own, all the draft analysts have their own, obviously way of ranking. So obviously 1 to 5, say example, in wide receivers, do you have shocks in yours? So say obviously most people have, Harrison Jr., Neighbors and Odunze as 1, 2, 3. Would yours be different, or do yours like sort of follow the same line, or as you say, with your analytics and style on that, do you say, for example, have Odunze second and Neighbors say fourth or fifth?
I think most people who do this would probably tell you that at the end of the day, rankings in a linear fashion, 1, 2, and 3 don't really matter all that much if they're in the same tier or close by in the same score. That the score is more important than the ranking, because if I'm looking for a slot heavy receiver, players going to play in the slot more often, who needs to be more explosive after the catch, then if I'm that team, I'm looking more for a Malik Neighbors type. If I'm looking for a boundary receiver who's going to win on contested plays and do some work in the middle of the field, but mostly play split end, the X position, it's probably going to be Marvin Harrison. If I'm looking for a player who maybe gives me a lot of the combination of both players to a degree, but also gives me more leaning towards Neighbors on the side of being able to run after the catch, it's going to be Odunze. So for me, since I'm not grading for a specific team, I'm trying to grade for the widest range of what the position requires, but also I'm looking at the depth of talent for it. When you combine those two factors, Neighbors is my number one, Odunze is my number two, and Marvin Harrison's my number three. But they're all in the same tier, And because really the differences are this. I mean, if you're as good as Harrison is, the buzz on him is mostly about production, the big school that he went to, that he started early with a lot of big names, and there's a lot of modeling that people use after that. But when you look at the film about route running and hands position at the catch point, his hands position at the catch point have some little dings against it where he's not using the optimal technique and drops passes that he shouldn't. He doesn't track the ball where he should. Does this mean that he's not one of the top scoring receivers I've seen in the past 5 years? Absolutely not. So, I mean, we could sit there and talk about the flaws that he has that may create some temporary growth issues for him, early in his career, or some mistakes that he has that always plague him a little bit, but I don't think it's anything that it's going to be deleterious to, his development as an NFL starter. He could be an instant NFL starter now. So it's just the fact that he's in a class that's very strong, and he has two other players who just happen to score a little bit higher than him when you look at the fact that they've made fewer mistakes that are repeatable types of errors that he's going to have to correct. So good route runner, good boundary receiver, not great after the catch compared to Odunze and Harrison, and Neighbors. He's not as dynamic in that regard. He's not a, quick change of direction player with sudden stop-start movements who can make you miss against unblocked defenders in the way to the caliber that Odunze and Neighbors can. And Neighbors is a more versatile player who has better route skills, probably has the best route skills of all three of them. Both at the line of scrimmage when he's facing man-to-man coverage, as well as against zone coverage and finding the openings. Whereas Odunze has good skills like that, but maybe not quite as wide of a breadth of talents with the number of routes that he can run as well. And I would say that Neighbors and Odunze are near equals, if maybe Neighbors not slightly better, as a pass catcher in a variety of ways. But again, it's like contrasting Stephon Diggs with Devontae Adams at the height of their careers. Some things they do better than others than the other, but are you going to really be upset that you got one over the other when they're playing at their peak football? And the answer is probably not, unless you're really splitting hairs on it. And somebody might tell you, have a drink and sit down for a minute before you talking about that.
Yeah, I guess it's also, obviously everyone puts their own rankings on there, but each team has their own different idea of what they want to play, how they want their wide receivers to play on there. So it may be, for example, that for the Bills, if we use the Bills, that the way they want to play, I'm not saying this is it because I probably don't have a direct line yet to Brandon Bean, that they may have, say, Odunze number one, Harrison number four, just based on what they want out of their wide receivers. Because I know that they've come out in the offseason and said they want more explosive, more dynamic, more yak and rack in there. Yeah. There may be a case that Odunze or Neighbors will be higher on their board than Harrison Jr. So it's always not... It's not saying that, as you said, not saying that Harrison Jr.'s rubbish or worse than those two, but it's just the way that each team value and know what they want out of their receivers.
Yeah, I mean, I was told this probably more than a dozen years ago by a scout who just said, listen, wide receiver has more variation in draft grades from team to team than any other position in the draft because of the fact that it's really three different positions. And then if you take the hybridization of that, they could play one to three roles. There's a lot of different combinations of what you're looking for. And also what they see as valuable for that particular offensive scheme or the type of quarterback. If your quarterback's an anticipatory thrower and really does a great job of seeing ahead of time to get the ball out, just as the receiver's at the top of his stem heading into his break, you know, there are certain receivers who are very strong timing route runners who do a good job with that. But if your receiver is stronger at winning contested catches on just routes that don't require that level of timing because they're vertical breaks, like, say, Marvin Harrison, not that he's weak at the others, but yeah, his strength is that, you know, you have a guy who might just see it and throw it and not anticipate it as much and say, just go up and get it and trust them to do it and place it in that area. Well, Harrison may be the guy that you would look for a little bit more. So, no, it's a terrific point, and it's one that's valuable. And I think it's one of the most valuable things about learning about football during this time of year is that the draft isn't just as much about where we rank players, because rankings, like you said, I will say, to borrow your phrase of it, rankings are rubbish. I say rankings suck, but we all want them, you know, and I had that in the beginning of all my chapters before I show my rankings just to explain why. But really it is. It's fascinating to see what NFL teams are thinking, why they're thinking it. And it gives us a broader understanding because the main media likes to talk about how teams out evaluate each other. And they're not really doing that. It's about how they value the board to hopefully get a surplus of value at the position that they're targeting. And because while we joke that it's a copycat league, and it is a copycat league, and there's a lot of similarities in schemes, there are still a lot of differences in personnel and scheme and combination that one team may look and say, we really love Keon Coleman. And another team goes, he's not even really a consideration on our board.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't work out, fans and media will use it to say, see, I told you Keon Coleman stunk. But if he succeeds, someone will say, I told you he was good, when really it somewhere lies in between, which is, did he fit with the right system? Did he have the right talent around him that exploited his traits in the way that did? And did he work at his craft to develop it? And it's usually not a clean answer to any single one. It's usually a combination of factors.
Yeah.
Can I ask Matt a question? American Matt, we had a really excellent draft analyst on the last show, Emery Hall, who was absolutely brilliant, just blew us
Emery's
away.
A friend of mine for sure.
I don't think he even looked down once. Normally you can see someone, they're reading something off the I don't think he even looked down, did he? Sure. He just knew it. He was absolutely just stand there like jaw on the ground. And one question I asked him last week was, well, okay, how long does it take you to really get a feel for a player, to evaluate a player? What is the process? And it triggered when you mentioned process in your introduction. And he said probably about 3 games. He said you can pretty much get a feel for a guy. And I wanted to ask a follow-up, and the conversation moved on. And what I wanted to ask was, when you're evaluating a player, and when you mentioned there about operations management, are you able, or is there any value in evaluating players, say, from their high school and then the college that they go to and then their freshman year and then their sophomore year? Or when you do this player evaluation, are you essentially evaluating the player today in 2024 and thinking what they could be in the draft? Or is there any way you can almost track their performance as they've gone through college and you can see and maybe use that as a way of almost projecting almost into the future? As I'm sort of thinking at it almost on a longer timeline and just saying, well, actually, we can maybe see this player move ahead, or are we just taking a snapshot as Riley is at today?
It's a wonderful idea and concept for sure to be able to do that. It would be great for that to happen. But because improvement isn't linear and because there's so much variation in terms of how football plays out. I mean, you have 22 bodies on the field. The ball bounces funny. It's not very predictable in terms of how it bounces like a baseball or basketball in American sports, where analytics are more king and predictable. You know, when I talk to people who have that analytical type of background to a higher degree than myself, but also have the film background and study, they'll tell you that as well. And people who've worked in the NFL in that capacity. But really, you know, because part of the problem is that people develop, while they also develop quick, you know, maybe in spurts or what they're exposed to, because it's a team sport and it's a performance sport. If you've ever been on a stage, whether it's doing plays or music or comedy or any form of acting, you realize that the higher level of talent around you that you play with, the faster you level up over a period of time, because they're reliable in hitting their marks and being timely and delivering it at a level where you're not having to overthink or compensate for their errors, because now you're doing what you're doing. So you level up faster. So some players, when they may have been high-end prospects in high school, but now they're on a team where, you know, a perfect example is Isaiah Pacheco of Rutgers, who I really liked, where some analysts may not get it right because they looked at him and said they're watching him run plays where the pulling guard or center isn't getting where they're supposed to be on a consistent basis, and it disrupts the entire play, and the running back now has to do work that he won't have to do in the NFL. And in fact, if he gets on a good team, he's going to have a little bit of an easier time in that area. And people might mistake it as that he had bad decision-making and bad vision.
Yeah.
When in fact, he was compensating for a situation that was suboptimal. So it's not really that linear. What I like to do is, you know, to answer the question you asked Emery and go back to that so that I can expand on a little bit more, is that, you know, I would say it usually takes anywhere between 1 to 3 games. If you're looking at the right things and you're very and there were times I would scoff when I would hear these reported stories of longtime coaches saying, I saw 3 plays and I knew that we needed to offer this kid a scholarship. And I go, oh, that's BS. But then after doing this for 19 years, I can say, no, I get it, because there is a level of imprinting that happens where you've seen enough and you've done your 10,000 hours. And if you understand the position, if you see the right combinations of events unfolding, you can see enough criteria from a certain number of plays where you can go, I saw that one game and I knew. But even so, if you're going to do your due diligence as a scout, you still study the other games as if you haven't seen enough yet to be skeptical about it. I mean, I can tell you, I saw Patrick Mahomes the summer before, and I'm known for this. If you look at my scouting report I have on mattwaldmanrsp.com on Patrick Mahomes, it's a bucket list scouting report. I mean, people have commented that it looks like I predicted the future, and I would, you know, I mean, it's, you know, for him and Lamar Jackson, both, you know, so you could, I'm proud of that, and I'm, you know, and it's not always going to happen that way, but I've had reports like that, and I show those. But when I saw Patrick Mahomes, I saw him the year before I was going to study him for my publication. I saw about 4 plays while I was getting ready to do something else. I was recording a game. It was a bowl game. It was, I think, Texas Tech LSU maybe in a bowl game. And I And I turned off the TV and said, I can't watch anymore because I need to wait till next year to see him because I got more to do. But I already know what this guy is. Like, this guy, I already know, and I can't wait. But then I watched enough games of him because I don't want to go with gut feeling. Mm-hmm. But I have to do my due diligence. There's a lot of gut feeling in what we do. We all have intuition, and we can't mm-hmm. act like it doesn't exist. But it's important that you remove the bias of that could be yeah. a potential bias, and have the detail so that you can stick to that and see if you can explain that. Because I remember seeing Nick Chubb. He was another one who I had rated as the number one running back in that draft class, and people called me nuts because I had him there. I watched him more than anybody because after seeing him after he got hurt and watching his first game back, and I thought, he doesn't look different to me. I heard all these people talking about how different he looked. And I thought, yeah. no, he still looks like the best back I've seen in college football. And I went and watched another probably 8 to 10 games of him and went through my process of doing it because, one, I was employed at the University of Georgia at the time. I've worked. I lived there for a long time. And I'm not a Georgia fan per se, but I knew that people would think that. And I wanted to be able to explain systematically what I saw. And so... Yeah. So, yeah, you can see it. You can have flashes of seeing things that make sense, but it's still probably best to honor the process
yeah.
and go through it, because there are times that I'll look at somebody and I go, ooh, I'm really excited about that. And then when I get into the dig into the details, I go, nope, that was an exciting play. That was it.
Hmm.
What? So based on that, then, obviously Josh Allen, obviously coming out, yeah. obviously Wyoming and all that, how did your perception, your grading of him back when in his draft year compared to where it is now? Did you see similarities, or was it like I was shocked and he's actually a pleasant surprise that he's actually turned out that way?
He had a score that graded out as someone who could contribute early, but would need really something schemed around him that would limit the deficiencies that he had and allow him to grow into a role. Usually what that means is that he could be a starter and had the physical skills to develop into that, but that to regard it with skepticism, given the fact that the NFL tends to throw players in and not give them the support they need, and B, that they don't do the work they need to get better because it's really incumbent upon them. So yeah. for me, I thought the NFL had it backwards with Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson. Not that Josh Allen couldn't be a quarterback, but people questioned Lamar Jackson a lot about him being a good pocket player and that he was just a runner and a thrower. And I asserted that he was the best pocket quarterback in the class, and that people were using basically his running ability is a crutch not to examine how good he was at standing in the pocket. And then he played in a legitimate NFL offense, whereas Josh Allen was a player that I thought needed a little bit more of some training wheels with the team that was going to allow him to run a little longer before, and that he was going to make mistakes as a decision maker that needed to be worked on, and that he could get into quicksand a little too often where he'd let one bad play turn into four bad plays. And I'm more skeptical usually of players like that. Cause you look at Drew Locke or Mitchell Trubisky or Zach Wilson, and they're all players who graded in that same range as Zach Wilson. I'm not Zach Wilson, as Josh Allen. But Josh Allen to me was kind of the exception in terms of, like, you know, I'm open to the idea of him becoming a starter, but the fact that he was able to make the strides he did and had an offense that catered to him early and found the way to go, you know what? You're the type of guy, quarterback, where we need routes that continue to break across the field so that you have multiple windows of opportunity to throw the ball and not be in a situation where they're static breaking routes and now they've got to reroute with you. And they've got to start all over. And Brian Daboll understood that. did a good job of finding talent that molded around that a lot. And Allen, to his credit, continued to develop and do the work to where he evolved. So he surprised me, but he didn't shock me. Does that make sense? Okay.
It does. It does. Yeah. So based on that, we'll move on to the draft and all that with the wide receivers and all that. Obviously, we've spoken about Harrison, Neighbors, and Odunze. Knowing what, obviously, how they built the offense and what Josh actually, how he likes to just put the ball straight in there, doesn't float it, doesn't give too many contested catches. What type of players, especially with a first, maybe second round grade, do you think would suit this Bills offense? Because obviously people start talking Brian Thomas Jr., Adonai Mitchell, Xavier Worthy, Ladd McConkey, and all that. Is there any that really fit what the Bills and Josh Allen can actually do?
Well, I mean, Josh Allen has some anticipation, but with that arm strength, he can buy time and be a see it, throw it type of player where he just drills it in there with his velocity and doesn't need to always use that level of timing. The real question is going to be with Gabriel Davis leaving, he was more of that third option in a progression offense where you would, if Allen beat the pressure, then he could throw it downfield to Davis who got behind the defense.
Yeah.
Or as a primary receiver, when they schemed the offense in a manner where all the resources were to misdirect the defense so that Davis could work wide open because he was not a guy who won one-on-one with timing routes. That was Stephon Diggs' job.
Yeah.
So Stephon Diggs is gone. Gabriel Davis is gone. Isaiah McKenzie is gone. And essentially your best receiver, in my opinion, is Khalil Shakir, who I really liked coming out, who's a flanker slot kind of hybrid. He can play flanker. He's a contested catch winner. He's good after the catch. He's a good route runner. The Bills were super cautious with him, like they were with with James Cook last year, when they really kind of wanted to make sure he understood pass pro and they didn't use him as much as they did in 2023. Well, they did the same thing a little bit with Khalil Shakir rookie year. He had some drops in camp, but he always made huge plays and some difficult plays in games. And I think they finally figured out that he can play. So he could be a surprise primary option as a flanker if they're willing to use him that way. But I think they're probably going to use him more in the slot. So as a result of that, yes, Brian Thomas Jr. makes sense as your split end type who can play that primary role of a mix of what Gabriel Davis and Stephon Diggs has to offer. He's one of those players who runs better routes than some people characterize because they see him as mainly a vertical complement to Neighbors, but he can drop his weight. He can come to quick stops and make the sharp turns you're looking for. He's not always as consistent in the intermediate game with those types of routes compared to the short game, but it'll come along. You can see that it's there. It's just a matter of refining it on a consistent basis. But he's a good pass catcher and he's got vertical skills. I would argue that if you're looking for a player who can give you a little bit more on the Gabriel Davis side, but you can also use him as an underneath option who can get you yards after the catch. He's a polarizing player, but Keon Coleman is that type of player. There's, when you look at him, he has the ability to separate within the first 5 to 10 yards of the line of scrimmage. He's someone that can get that early separation, run intermediate routes, and get that step on a defender early for curl routes and comebacks and digs. And while he's not super fast, he uses his size well to win the contested ball late. He's not the late separator, but he's the guy that you can throw it and he's going to win it. And after the catch, not only does he break tackles or hurdle you, but he was a punt returner in school. And when you return punts, you have to be efficient in tight spaces and be excellent at being able to handle high traffic. And he does that at a high level. So I've joked that he's like the LeGarrette Blount of wide receivers in the sense that he's not super fast, but he's very agile and he's a much smarter weapon than the average fan understands. in terms of what he can do. So I think he'd fit there. Ricky Pearsall is another one who's a speedster who can give you a little bit more of that Stephon Diggs mold because he's a decent route runner, a very good at the aerial artistry of adjusting to footballs. And he's a smart enough player to adjust to different receivers in the passing game, or adjust to different quarterbacks in the passing game in terms of when they have to go off script. I'm rooting for him to go to an old rival in your old division, which is to be reunited with Anthony Richardson, because he and Richardson worked very well together 2 years ago when Richardson had to go off script or when he had to buy time in the pocket and manipulate and then go back to him. So, I mean, those are some of the players that right off the bat to me that would probably be good fits because they could play multiple positions for you,
yeah,
inside and outside, and you could give a player like Khalil Shakir a chance to develop even more into a larger role.
Yeah. I mean, the other polarized one, I know most, well, we got group chat and most people like him, and obviously loads of people on Bill's Twitter actually like as well, is Xavier Leggett. Obviously, how does he fit the system that much, or is he more of a, as you said, a Z or an X type, and he may play one position, or does he have that little flexibility? And is the production with him there? Because I think he didn't really come into full production till like the season last year or something like that. If I read right.
Yeah, I'm not always as worried about the modeling of production. I'm just more worried about what the techniques they exhibit and whether they've shown improvable skills or areas that you can project improvement with. And when you look at Xavier Leggett, you can see that he has some ability to bend his hips, which means that he can develop in a way to drop his weight into hard breaks, which are most of the routes that you're going to see that are timing routes that are in the immediate range of the field. Like I said, the comebacks, the digs, the curl routes. Yeah. Those are the money routes that Stephon Diggs won with on 3rd and 15 with a player like Jalen Ramsey covering him and knowing that the route was coming, but still couldn't stop it. And it was at the end of the game and Josh Allen could rely on him. Those are primary receiver routes. Xavier Leggett is not at that point yet. He does not run those routes well yet. He is more of a vertical boundary receiver who can be a possession guy on certain routes, but he doesn't drop his weight well into those timing routes and tell those stories well enough yet in an efficient manner. What you're really seeing is a guy who can win contested catches and then run after the catch on routes where he's breaking open in zones. So if you have him working over the middle, more like Gabriel Davis running routes that were timing routes, he can play more of that Gabriel Davis-like role and do it better, in my opinion, because you don't have to feed him five balls and watch him juggle two or catch two. He's going to actually catch the football because he doesn't clap attack like Davis does. He actually has his hands together more often. So there's potential for him maybe to develop into a primary receiver, but at this stage, he's more of a guy that people are valuing for his athletic ability than they are for his current skill sets that actually translate to reliable NFL play as a starter. He's more of a third or fourth receiver right now who's going to give you exciting plays when he's matched up against a safety or a nickel corner who is overmatched by his size, or you can get him up against a linebacker. Think Kenny Golladay with the Detroit Lions when he started off with the Lions and they had Golden Tate and Marvin Jones, two excellent technicians, and they could match him up against an underwhelmed linebacker or nickelbacker with his size and strength and catching ability, but the route running wasn't quite there, and he never developed his route running, and he washed out with Dable in New York.
Yeah. So going on then, obviously, with all the metrics and the analytics, obviously we know Bills at the moment, unless they trade up or trade down, only really have two picks in the first three rounds. Who are those day three guys that exhibit that trait to become that primary, potentially that primary receiver, a guy that takes what Gabe Davis did and what Shakir did? Even if we go back a few years, old friend of the show, Stevie Johnson, obviously seventh round, and he turned out to be one of the better route runners and better wide receivers in the league. Using those sort of the analytics that you do, is there any day threes that really project that could be a primary or at least secondary target in sure. the passing game.
Sure. You know, and I think the guys that you all mentioned were all kind of secondary options that but that's good. I mean, these secondary, if you're a starter that and you get someone that late, that's great. Someone who might fall because of potential concerns about his character, and I don't study character because really the NFL, they have a team of investigators. Or good NFL teams have teams of investigators doing that work. Bad NFL teams have scouts who don't know how to interview people and don't really know how to do their due diligence and are allowed to editorialize and make decisions on things that they really are above their pay grade but are asked to do. And I could go into a lot of stories about those things. But but one example, Jermaine Burton, if he drops due to questions about how he takes coaching and how he deals with people, and it turns out that it was really a non-issue, but some teams overreacted to it. Mm. The player he reminds me of is a former draft pick of the Buffalo Bills, and that's Robert Woods. He can play all three positions. He's someone that runs excellent routes. He really understands how the importance about running routes is that you have to be efficient with how you bait defenders. And you have to understand the different techniques that you use to sell them in that tight space and time. I often joke about it like Alfred Hitchcock. Okay. A good route runner tells a suspenseful story in a very succinct way. And there's a story about the great director, producer, Mike Nichols, at a film festival in, I think in London. And he was there with Alfred Hitchcock and they were at a hotel in the same hotel together. And he met Alfred Hitchcock at his room and they came out and they were talking about just mundane things. They got into the elevator and they're still talking about just everyday type of stuff. And a gaggle of people came in into the elevator and Alfred Hitchcock immediately just without missing a beat started describing this gruesome murder scene. and you could just hear a pin drop and there are all these women in there and just think about the time of when he was telling the story and what our society was like, you know? So everybody was quiet and kind of hushed and aghast that he was telling this gruesome story. And when the door rang and the bell rang for it to open into the main lobby, he just stood there, even though everyone was behind him, he stood there with Mike Nichols and everybody was there frozen. And then finally realized they were being rude, waiting for him to keep telling the story. And they all kind of hushed and ran out. And then he walked out and just kept and reverted back to the conversation he and Mike were having before he told the story. So this succinct story going down like six floors. And Mike Nichols was like, "What the hell was that?" And he goes, "Oh, that's just my elevator story." You know, so it's like wide receivers have to be able to tell that succinct type of story that's suspenseful where the cornerback thinks they've guessed the outcome of the plot.
Yeah.
And you're letting them think they've guessed it and you pull out the rug from them. You pull the rug out from under them. And that's what good receivers do. And Jermaine Burton does that well. He can also win the contested balls, even though you're not asking him all the time to be that. It's just whether or not his character is one of those things. So, you know, I look for players who can do things like that. Anaya Smith is another one who will probably fall because he had a driving while intoxication charge 2 years ago that included an illegal firearm possession. Ooh. and a marijuana charge. Now in the US, if we parse this out, the marijuana is quickly not becoming a big deal. And the NFL really, they just play a game where they basically are telling you, you know, they're telegraphing to you, you've got to be an idiot to fall under our testing guidelines because we pretty much make it clear how you can avoid it. And then the gun charge, well, in the state of Texas, you know, that's about just getting a permit. And really in the South United States, it's pretty much that. That's just a level of like, you should be more careful about how you manage your firearm. And then the DWI is a big deal. If he can show that that's something that he's matured from and they believe him, he might get drafted. If not, he might be an undrafted free agent, but he's a terrific route runner. He has excellent hands. He was a former running back recruit at Texas A&M who were much like another player who became an excellent wide receiver and a Pro Bowl wide receiver who started his career at Notre Dame as a running back, finished as a receiver. And everybody was like, why didn't we recruit this kid as a wide receiver? He was this good. was Golden Tate. And Anaiah Smith has a lot of Golden Tate to his game. He can play flanker. He can play inside. So you could switch him in and out with Khalil Shakir and kind of get some ability there if you like that as an idea. Maybe another guy that drops to day three that would be in that realm might be Luke McCaffrey, or maybe Javon Baker falls a little further than what the fans think.
Yeah. You know,
both of those guys that can play multiple positions, they're decent route runners. They can go up and win the ball. Baker has some skills after the catch that are pretty strong. I would say McCaffrey has a little bit more to work on as a man-to-man route runner, so he'd be better starting off in the slot. But, you know, they all have those skills. This is a very deep receiver class, so don't be surprised if players that would normally be available in rounds 2 through 5 will be available in rounds basically 4 through 6, 4 through 7. Yeah.
One name I've liked, and obviously I'll do get your view on it, is Brendan Rice.
Yeah, obviously, sure.
With him, is he obviously, do you see that primary or secondary, or is he more of your third, fourth, your Gabe Davis type off the bat?
No, I think he can develop into a secondary receiver as more of what you're looking for from a guy who can run routes, win the ball in tight coverage, and win after the catch. He's very good after the catch. He's underrated. It's kind of funny to say this, but he's a lot like his dad coming out in the certain ways. You know, maybe not to the degree of talent, but like his dad, he has some issues with clap attacking footballs and dropping more balls than you would expect. So he's got to work on that. But he can make tough catches over the middle. He can make some contested plays. He's physical in that realm. He's a good route runner. He can drop his weight. He can set up defenders. He's efficient with how he does that work. And he's not bad off the line, though he can get a little bit better. He's not as fast off the line or quick off the line as his dad. His dad was super quick off the line. And then when you take a look at what he does after the catch, he's great at getting his feet up and over defenders, which is a really hidden talent of the best runners after the catch, whether they're running backs or wide receivers, is getting the knees and feet high. And so he excels in that realm. So for him, it's just a bad matter of getting a little bit better against man-to-man coverage, being better at making catches with the right technique with targets that are over his head and away from his frame. But I think that, you know, maybe early on he's more of a number three or number four, but by the end of the first year, early second year, with the, you know, with the work that he should be able to do, he should be in a position to be the number two receiver on a team by the end of his contract, no later than that. So, no, he's a nice prospect.
You got anything, Robin?
Trying to think. What's the general feeling of, I suppose, depth of wide receivers this year? I've heard various things that it's like a very deep wide receiver class, but ultimately, when it comes to later rounds, perhaps somewhat shallow, so very strong in, say, the first 100 picks. But after that, it kind of does tail off. Is that the sort of sense where we're getting, that the really top talent is in those first three rounds? Then after that, you're probably looking at more development and project type receivers?
I don't think so. Actually, oh, okay. I think actually this is one of – we have to look at the projection in reality. With okay, so – The it's easy to say that as a hedge, I would say, from the standpoint of the argument of that, because they're not being blatant about talking about that there's a lot of competition already in the league who are equally talented or now equally developed, or if not more developed than them, stepping in. And because the opportunities are not always there, there may be people who don't want to say this guy has starter level talent because they know that he's going to get drafted in the fourth or fifth round. And they play the game of projecting rounds as a way of accuracy rather than actually scoring the player based on his film and saying this guy's talented. And if he gets the right opportunity and lands in a situation where there isn't talent available due to injury, suspension, or retirement, or just, you know, those types of factors, But people don't do that because they get graded based on what round they predicted. I don't predict rounds. So that's why I've often put players who are, I say, look, this player's probably going to get undrafted, but he's in my top five, and I don't care. Because if he gets the opportunity, I'm judging talent. I'll do something else later with another part of the publication I do after the draft to start for fantasy people and to talk about the pragmatic side of it. But right now, when I look at talent, there's 18 wide receivers that have immediate starter grades on my board. That's unprecedented. I mean, I've been doing this 19 years. You know, there are players ranked outside my top 12 who would have been in my top five last year or the past 2 years. You know, does that mean there are? Now, I tell my readers, listen, due to, you know, maturity off the field, whether they have the work ethic or they go onto a loaded wide receiver chart or they're asked to do something that's maybe outside what they do best. And because for whatever reason or injury, you could probably divide the number of players that I think are going to be have a potential to be a factor by the end of their first contract by six or seven and divide it by six or seven. And that's probably your fudge factor as to how many are actually going to have any kind of minimal impact. So, you know, I may tell you 18 players have starter level potential, but I know that if we divide that by seven, you're really looking at like about somewhere between two to three are actually going to have that level of impact. And if I divide the 20 something players that I think could be a wide receiver three with some legitimate weekly value, like Gabriel Davis had at a minimum, you know, you're still looking at, you know, maybe four to six players. And that's a lot because the last class that was that way was 2014's class that had Devontae Adams, Odell Beckham Jr., Sammy Watkins.
Bills traded up to get him as well, didn't it? Didn't he give up next year, the following year's first?
Yeah.
And he was a fantastic talent, but we didn't know that he was a drinker. We didn't to the level that he was and that – there were, you know, he had some good seasons and that he wasn't healthy all the time. And there are the combination of factors that, you know, you don't always know. But it was still a great class. Mike Evans was a part of that class. Brandon Cooks was a part of that class. So if this class is on par with that from potential, it's a very strong group.
Yeah, so it's more – so in essence, you really want to try and look more – I think I mentioned this to Emery in the show – that you want to really look at the – film tape rather than what they do in combine and pro days with obviously with your 40s, your broad dashes and all that. Yes, it's obviously good to measure the explosive, but that only gets you so far from it. You just have to go really to tape to actually say, right, yes, I can see he does this well, he does these routes quite well, but yet there's still a bit to work on. So he based it based on the film rather than the workout, so to speak.
It's a combination of things, to be honest, because the workouts have some value, just like tape has value. But when I hear people say tape doesn't lie, I would say tape doesn't lie, but your eyes do if you're untrained.
Yeah.
All the time. You know, why do you think, you know, I'm sure you've watched your share of court dramas and watched eyewitnesses talk about what they saw definitively only to be proven that what they thought they saw was completely incorrect. And that happens in this industry. So it's important to understand that with the 40 times and things like that, they are problematic. One of my colleagues who I do a week, every other week podcast with, Brandon Angelo, he's a track and field expert. He works with track and field athletes as his full-time job. And we talked about how the combine has a method of timing that is basically a laser start, hand time finish. That's the third best out of like four options that are available on the market, which means that there's an error, plus or minus error rate of about 0.15 or 0.15 seconds. That's the difference between... that's a huge difference, as we know.
Yeah.
So if it's that bad, and the reason that why they do that, you say, well, it's the NFL, it's so expensive. It takes a lot, you know, they have all this money. Yeah. Why aren't they using the best of the best? Because you need scouts trained on using the system to do it. You also have, you know, and that takes some time. So there's part of that. Even different surfaces have different plus minus factors. Scouts have databases where they know that if you're running at Ohio State, Ohio State demands that their players run on their surface, and their surface is known to be blatantly faster than the average. Whereas whereas USC has had players run during a monsoon and not cared, you know? So you have, they keep track of these things to say,
yeah,
we have a plus or minus factor. Ultimately, you have to know what you're watching for and how they separate and who they separate with and how much speed and all these different things are factors, but where they show up on the field. Like, we overrate speed. People do modeling of it, but, and they point to the success of their models, but really, some of these things don't have as much signal as they portray. It's just like a dozen years ago when they said receivers need to be at least 210 pounds and over 6'2", and we should just X out all these players who are not Odell Beckham, Steve Smith Jr., Isaac Bruce, Tyreek Hill, Jalen Waddle, Devonta Smith. Should I name another dozen more who were under those requirements that some teams, Philadelphia Eagles, listen to an analytics person and threw out players before they even watched them.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, oh, this is a nice layer. Let's watch everybody, make our list of who we think really has talent, and now apply that to it. And if we want to say we prefer, you know, a 6'2 player who's really good over a 5'10 player who's really good, I'm good with that. As opposed to saying, let's pick a player that's going to be out of the league in 2 years over a player who, because he's taller and heavier than a player that's going to wind up being a multiple Pro Bowl option.
Yeah. So let's switch up the last little bit before we wrap up. We'll switch up. Obviously, the Bills probably are in a market for probably day three below for a running back to complement James Cook. With obviously how the Bills like to run the ball and how they started running the ball last year under Brady, and they've had 30 visits given to Trey Benson out of FSU, and is it Austin Estime?
Audric Estime, you got it.
Notre Dame. Who do you see that could fill that complementary role and fit the scheme to James Cook?
Sure. I mean, if you want speed and you want someone running primarily a gap-based offense, which is, you know, what the Bills run a lot of, which is power and trap and toss plays and counter, you know, Trey Benson would be an immediately good fit. And if he fell far enough because of the depth of talent at other positions, he would be a nice get for them because he can give you that big play compliment, who also is developing enough as a zone runner that he's not consistently just bouncing plays outside unnecessarily, and he's sticking with the play design. He does run pretty hard, so he'll run through contact and be able to attack. You want running backs who attack at full speed when they get at defenders, and his pad level is pretty good in that realm to do that. He's someone that's still developing a bit as a pass protector. He has good hand-eye coordination as a receiver, but he's not the greatest route runner, and he clap attacks some balls that he's going to have to get a little bit better at. But you're probably not going to expect him to be used as anything more than a screenplay dump-off option right now. You're going to let James Cook do a lot of that work anyhow. But he's a nice option if he falls enough that you feel like it's a bargain and you can get a 1-2 punch and you can take a little bit off Cook. Kamani Vidal is a nice player in that regard who you can get maybe in the mid-rounds or a little bit later, who's out of Troy. He's a lot of what people thought, a lot of people wanted to see from DeAndre Swift, but DeAndre Swift is not. DeAndre Swift is a space player who's not very strong inside unless you put him with a running quarterback who can create box advantages in the middle of the field where you get two-on-one advantages with your blocker to the defender, and then he can run in the middle because it looks like space, open space. Okay, but otherwise, he's an open space player who can catch some. But Vidal actually is a rugged interior runner with a low center of gravity who has more acceleration and speed than DeAndre Swift as a combo. He's one of the better pass protectors in the class in terms of the physical techniques that you're looking for to be able to strike and get a square position. He has to get a little bit better with how to diagnose certain types of blitzes like, you know, different twists, you know, different games like tackle and twists. Sometimes or delayed blitzes, he can have a little bit of an issue with. But overall, he's an intriguing player. Late round, if you want to go for someone that, or two players that, let's go with one. One that I think is I'll do two. One player that I think is probably rising a little bit more because, again, I joke that speed is the cleavage of NFL evaluators. They see it and they lose their minds and they stop, you know, any kind of level-headed discourse sometimes. Is Isaac Garendo out of Wisconsin and Louisville. I think he's actually a good fit in a gap scheme and could play well for you. He's got that special teams experience, and he's very good at that, and the Bills value that very highly. So they could get a player who can not only come in and contribute on special teams, that cuts down the salary of another player that they don't need to have on their roster because they can use him on special teams and at running back. And he can develop along those lines because he's a rugged mover with a lot of speed and gliding burst that gets on top of defenders earlier than you'd expect. And he's developing a little more as a zone runner, a little bit more as a pass protector, but he has enough skills that he could contribute as that change of pace. My favorite player that probably fits in this realm, who's not very fast, but he is quick. He is a powerful runner. He is a versatile runner who can run between the tackles and outside, and a terrific receiver and a good pass protector, is University of Washington running back Dylan Johnson. To me, Dylan Johnson is one of the five best running backs in this class in terms of what you're looking for in terms of versatility of blocking scheme that you can run behind, ability to break multiple tackles and have contact balance, decision-making, pass protection, you know, passing game. You just lack speed. And you know what? Arian Foster lacked speed. Didn't really care. You know, that it shouldn't matter. Audric Estime wouldn't be bad either, to be honest. I mean, I think your suggestion of him, he could work out well there. So could Ray Davis, except that with Ray Davis out of Kentucky, he's not a very strong pass protector at this stage. He's also going to have to do a better job of diagnosing pass pro opportunities, and he drops his head too much, which means that when you drop your head, you don't see what you're hitting. Defenders can go around you, or they can just knock you on your butt. You know, and so that happens with him, but he's a fun runner. He's kind of a Zach Moss type in terms of like what Moss did later in his career and what they were hoping, what he showed at Utah, but didn't do very well early on.
Yeah. So last thing, I'm going to do three names that some of them have been, well, one of them is, no, I don't think any of them really been mentioned to the Bills, and just see how they fit on there. One is out of Wisconsin, Braylon Allen. The other one is a son of another legend in Frank Gore Jr. And one from Georgia, Kendall Milton.
Okay.
So, how any of those fit? Do any of those really fit with what the Bills do, or be a good fit for the Bills?
Sure. In fact, you know, you mentioned, I would say two of the three are. Frank Gore's more like what Devin Singletary is, the outlier version of Frank Gore Jr. Okay. He's short, he's small, he's slow, not particularly quick, but he has unbelievable vision and decision-making skills and good change of direction efficiency. And that's what made him the exceptional outlier to actually even be a complimentary starter for the Buffalo Bills. Okay. Frank Gore is people hoping that he'll be that outlier to that. He's a good college player, but I don't think he has that kind of decision-making talent. We'll see if he surprises. I'll root for him. Hope he does. Kendall Milton, you know, as a prospect out of college, out of high school, as Robin alluded to early on with the questions about, you know, what would be cool to be able to project, you know, from high school on, you know, he was a five-star prospect on par with Bijan Robinson when he came out. They were 1-2, those two players. Okay. He doesn't have the home run hitting speed to be that player, but he's still a quality NFL prospect. He is someone that, and that's part of the problem, is like when you look at development, Saquon Barkley was like a 185-pound running back coming out of school when he came to Penn State. So he, and when you looked at his, you know, metrics in terms of performance and workouts, they weren't very strong. Whereas Nick Chubb looked like a grown ass man in high school. There's literally picture of him in a track event leaping, and he's leaping almost shoulder height and like warming up for a sprint that he's about to get into. And he's literally wider than two track athletes together next to him at the meet. I mean, he looked like the Incredible Hulk with Spider-Man's like next to him, you know, whereas Saquon Barkley looked like Spider-Man Jr., you know, when he entered that. But then by the time he got to the combine, he was bigger than Chubb, faster than Chubb, and, you know, very dynamic. So it's not linear. When you look at Milton, what happens a lot with these prospects, to make this point, to bring it all the way home, is that these guys are often, I joke, the big men in the little coat. They're the big kid in school who got the growth spurt early, and they're already a man by the time they're 16, 17, 18. And then everybody catches up to them when they get to that level, you know, because Josh Allen, I believe, was like Carson Wentz and Aaron Rodgers, where early on they didn't get recruited early to big schools because they were short and they weren't very big. And then they hit the growth spurt.
Yeah.
And then teams were like, oh, okay. So Milton was one of those early growth guys. He's very powerful. He's a pretty smart runner. He ran with a little bit more urgency and power to break tackles at the end of his career. I can't attribute why that was. I could only estimate. But I'll just say that, you know, or speculate what it is. I don't want to speculate. I'll just say that he ran harder, you know, and he broke more tackles, and he seemed to attack with a little bit more urgency on certain plays that he didn't do early on in his career. He could be a compliment, but he's never going to be a guy you're going to confuse with we need him to start, be the starter and get 15, 18 touches every week unless there's just an injury. Braylon Allen might be that guy. Braylon Allen might be that guy. He's the type of guy that the Bills have a good fit. He could work well in that system. He has the speed you're looking for. If you give him the runway, and gap schemes give you that runway, he has good feet on certain runs where you see some efficiency and dynamic ability, and he can catch the ball. The problem is that, you know, have you ever gone to the pub and had a sandwich that was like, it tasted awful, but then you looked at certain components of it and you go, if you just removed this, it would have been a good sandwich. If you removed that, it would have been a good sandwich. I feel like you watch reps of Braylon Allen and it's like every rep is a different sandwich, but there's something bad. The lettuce is rotten in this sandwich. The meat's rancid in this sandwich. The tomato and this one has mold on it, you know. And when you watch his game, it's like if you could take all those things out, you could build the perfect sandwich, but you just don't. But you know, the problem is can this dude figure out how to make a good sandwich and like look in the refrigerator and be a little more careful? And if he can tie his game together where the footwork, the decision making, where he's not trying to bounce too many things, where he's actually try not to use inefficient cuts where his feet get out too far inside his frame and he topples over on plays that you see way too often when he's trying to change direction to the open field. If he can eliminate that from his game, he has starter capacity. The problem is there's a lot of little details that tell you either A, he's not working at his craft and he's leaning on his talent. Like Devontae Parker, the wide receiver with the Patriots, who, you know, there's a lot of little things missing in his game. The God-given talent, or what is he learned enough to ingrain and integrate his athletic ability in, are good. But the details that separate you from becoming a consistently good player against other top athletes who have those same athletic skills, and they're 325 pounds or they're 185 pounds and they can still tackle you because they're in the top one percentile of all football players. That's when you have to be more consistent, and you can't just be the biggest kid in the class, you know, anymore.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to add, Robin, before we close up?
I was going to ask a question about the future of the running back position, but I just think it's probably going to. I think we'll say that let's try and get Matt back on again, so we can try and extract some more knowledge, because this has just been absolutely fascinating this whole hour.
Dog's enjoyed it thoroughly now, so I apologize on behalf of him.
That's all right. Robin's got dogs to make appearance on the show anyway, so it's all good.
Grabbed into shot about 2 minutes ago. I kept having to push him out of the camera.
He's a box safety. He literally is a strong safety who plays in the box. And he's about 60 pounds of muscle, but his buddy's a German Shepherd who's about 120 pounds, and together they came down the hill and blindsided me at a dog park about 3 months ago and sprained my ankle in three places. And what's funny is the crutches I have, literally to make smack talk even better, is that the crutches that I got actually are the brand, are the name of my dog. Where can I find it here?
Oh,
yeah, God. Hugo. Yeah, so the next day I looked at it, his name is Sir Hugo. My wife named him Sir Hugo. but Sir Hugo, he has earned the title, I would say, but it took him about a year. But this was one of those moments that, maybe he temporarily lost it.
But no, anyway, Matt, thank you ever so much for coming on the show. For our listeners who aren't following you and all that, where can they find you, and obviously everything that you every job that you're in, work that you do?
Sure. So, you can find me, down here at Matt Waldman on X. I do a lot of videos. If you search that plus whatever name of a player at quarterback, running back, wide receiver, tight end, odds are you'll find at least 2 to 3 videos, if not more, where I break that down. If you want more in-depth videos, you can go to my YouTube channel, Matt Waldman's RSP Film Room, where I've done nearly 800 videos over the course of over a decade, from short form and long form, with former players, current players, some coaches, not NFL coaches, but players who coached, like Will Hewlett, who I talked about, who's a quarterback coach to, he's worked with Caleb Williams. He's worked with Anthony Richardson, Brock Purdy. I've supplied scouting reports to him in the past of some of the players that he's worked with. We've done stuff together to Jamal Williams. When he came out, his agent asked me to do some work with them and do some video watching. So that and media folks. So I break down the game on those positions. I've been doing it for over a decade. MattWaldman.com. If you just want to buy the book after you've heard what me go on forever with some of this stuff, it's a choose your own adventure draft guide. It's bookmarked, so you don't have to feel compelled to try and read all 1,183 pages. You can do it in spurts. If you want to go explore the deep end for a little bit and get out quick, you can do that. If you want to play in the shallows a little bit, you can do that. But you're going to learn football, and you're going to learn, a point of view that's really about that value. And it comes with a post-draft that's very much fantasy-oriented, because I'm a senior staff writer at Football Guys. I've been there since 2009 and been in the fantasy football industry since 2003. I think that's enough. If you find me at any of those three places, you'll probably also find the podcast I do 3 to 5 days a week. So
that's awesome. No, that's awesome. Matt, thank you ever so much for coming on. And everyone listening, get onto him, actually follow him, and just absorb the knowledge that me and Robin have absorbed today. And obviously for Robin, for Matt, and myself, Matt, it's thank you for listening, and let's go Buffalo Bills.
Go Bills.
It's a pleasure.
You don't know anything about work? He's not. That's who we are. 1, 2, 3,